listening to Around Comics.
You are listening to Around Comics, episode 429, Sandman versus Sandman.
So we're back to the old intro, the longer cut.
You know, people complain. I'm with them.
I stand with you, my brothers and sisters. I like the longer intro. I got to do a little chair dancing. I got to get my groove on.
It's like when you watch like old TV shows on streaming and you're like, oh my God, these opening sequences are so like,
right?
Oh my God, we did this all the time? You know, like
28 times in a season? Like what?
It's like skip intro. Like,
I don't need to see the Game of Thrones intro on like perpetual repeat.
Changed it as the seasons went on. They were adding stuff.
Brilliant, right?
So that was actually kind of interesting that they did that.
Yeah. Like,
what's happening, gentlemen?
I don't need to see the Doom Patrol intro for like the 15th, the 2 minute long where I'm like, God damn, this is long. Get me into the action. Yeah, get me into the action.
Just give me Robot Man.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't need intro.
I'm going to throw this out right now. If you haven't watched the show, if you haven't read the comic, this is going to be chock full of spoilers because I want to talk about the Sandman.
We need a chucker horn.
Nice. Nice. You're going cartoonist kayfabe on us.
I have an extra camera set up now.
Next level.
Right?
If we want to, I don't know how this works, but we can kind
this
of.
This cropping shows that I'm wearing shorts.
This cropping shows my tennis clothes in the corner.
I don't know how else to do it. It doesn't seem.
That's fine.
I don't mind.
Warn a brother next time that he's got to clean up his office.
Clean up your dirty office, you filthy bastards. Yeah. I thought you could somehow, I could remove us.
No, I love it. No, this is perfect. No. Go back. Sounds great.
Like that?
You on the left. Yes.
Now
that works for me.
Thrilling audio commentary.
It's you controlling the book.
Because I got to reach over.
Tom and I, in here.
Oh, I dropped the pencil.
This is next level.
Huh? Huh? Yeah. Look at that.
I like it.
Wow.
I like it. Wow. Very cool.
How about that? A little something.
Hats off to you.
I have read the entire first absolute edition of Sandman, reread it, and along with watching the entire first season of Sandman in preparation for this Sandmanaganza.
Did the TV the first big question?
Sandmania.
Did the TV show help you get over that kind of what we've described as the Sandman hump, where it's like, I know it's supposed to be great, and I bottom out at about like issue 3 and can't get through it. The show helped get me over that and kind of into the series after Gaiman knows it's going to be an ongoing. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I've read all of Sandman before. Yeah. I know what you're talking about. You know, we talked about this, I think last week a little bit, in the idea of like, you know, it can be a bit of a struggle. It's a dense book. There's a lot going on. It's not your typical comic book. And there's a part where it's like, yeah, there's so much kind of going on in the first 8 issues. And he talks about it. I listen, you know, the Mark Maron podcast, he talks about like, he wasn't sure if it was going to get past 8 issues. So he doesn't necessarily know if he had more ideas, although I think he did, because in this edition, there is a huge section in the back that is like the entire outline that he sent to Karen Berger, on Sandman. So it's like he wrote out like a 9-page outline. Look at this fantastic intro sort of illustration. But yeah, he wrote out an entire outline on it, which goes over like 4 or 5 pages in the book about his ideas for the series. But the bulk of it is really the beginning of it. For sure.
Well, you know, you talk about the denseness of it. It, you know, it's almost Watchmen-esque in its connections as you go through, you know, the first, like, you know, 12 issues or so. It's just like these complex relationships that sometimes span, you know, hundreds of years. And it's hard to the bell curve on that before you get the payoff of, oh, that's fucking cool. That was always my difficulty. And now that I'm like, oh, everything is connected, it kind of opens the story up and gives it a really nice through line that I can kind of grab onto.
Yeah, I could absolutely see that. I mean, it's, I think one of the things, well, first I should say, I loved the TV series. I thought it was, you know, terrific, and it was worth the 30-year wait to allow Gaiman to actually do it right, mm-hmm. the way that he, right. you know, and that's another thing he talks about. It's like, yeah, he's turned down movie, like, offers for the Sandman. Yeah. He's turned down TV show offers because they just weren't right. And you know, it was this interesting thing of, like, the right time, the right technology, mm-hmm. you know, letting him, the guy that actually wrote it, actually be in charge of it.
I mean, is this his magnum opus? You know, I know that's unfair because it's like his first comics work, but I mean, is this his magnum opus?
I mean, he basically created a 75 issue comic series about himself.
Right.
That's, you know, he stars as the character, basically.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean,
so he's not going to, what I'm getting at is that he's not going to let this be done in any other way than the perfection that he wants it to be. That would be my assumption, is like, it's that personal to him.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's hard to say. I think it's a struck, just because 20 years ago, 15 years ago, nobody's given a comic book writer control over a massive television series, a 10 episode, right. multi-million dollar, nobody's given him the reins on that.
Yeah.
And it's say what you will about the MCU, but it's the success of something like Marvel Comics that then leads to, you know, something like Netflix going, okay, yeah, we'll let Neil Gaiman do this. He'll be
there's a market for it.
It's also this
all connected.
It's also, frankly, the sweet spot before all this money runs out.
Yeah, definitely.
Where it's like, actually, no, we're not gonna let comic. We're gonna just make reality shows about, like, you know, like. Yeah. So he got in there. Just as it was like the technology was enough and there's enough money flowing around and enough, like, yeah, let's, you know, we got to make a bunch of stuff. Let's this guy run it before the, actually, no, we're not going to do that anymore, which I think is coming.
You feel the bubble is going to burst.
Why should we pay for Sandman whenever we can make another cooking competition?
Yeah. I mean, I think you guys talked about this last week, but like the HBO Max stuff, I think is like a harbinger of like, of a lot of these streaming services are going to be, we've been sort of living in like a golden age of like, if you have an idea, like, and it's pretty good,
yeah,
you'll make it, you know, you'll get it. Like, who knows if you'll get another season of it, but like, there's so much stuff that comes out that like, you don't even know, like, aren't even aware of. Like, it's just such an insane amount of streaming stuff.
Netflix made a show about a, like, top shelf book about zombies. And it was good.
You know, so I happened to run across this article on a site, a comic book site, and I thought it was kind of funny, and I was going to bring it up tonight. And I think this is the perfect time to bring it up. So there was an article about how IDW announces 5 new TV shows.
Yes.
Across HBO, Cartoon Network, and Universal. Can you guess what any of the 5 shows would be from IDW? What properties?
I saw the list, and I knew None of the five.
None of them. Not one of them.
Not one that I ever read or was even remotely aware of. And I'm just like, I am a terrible comics fan now because.
No, I don't think you are, because it's the delicacy.
Right.
A graphic novel from two people I've never heard of. Yeah. Rivers. Wild Dark Spaces, Wildfire.
That's who's the creator on that? That's the one that
Scott Snyder. It's Scott Snyder.
Yeah, that's the one. It's like, oh, I know that name.
I know the name. I never read the comic. Ballad for Sophie, and Brutal Nature. Ariel Olivetti is the artist on that. Yeah, I've never heard of any of these properties yet. Five of them just announced from IDW. So I don't know if
they're not buying rights. They're actually making these.
Well, I'm just saying,
right?
We're gonna see. We'll see if things come out.
Yeah, they're in development. That doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
Yeah. I was also gonna say the other sweet spot that this book is in too is like, it's sort of from a different time. It's it's weird to think of like comics from like the late '80s, early '90s as being like. From a different time, but it's from a different time when like it's very much a comic book and it's a little esoteric and kind of like weird in a way that, I don't know, comics are quite weird in that. Comics are weird in a different way, but like that very like writerly, like kind of like a little stuffy sometimes, but like also like a little. It's got that flavor to it, right? And I don't mean that in a bad, like, that's like the airs it has, of like, and I think like, as you read through it, like it gets better and it gets like stronger and more, like anything when someone gets to take their time to like unfold the whole thing, it's like, oh yeah, this is going to be, get better and better. But it is like, I haven't watched the show yet, but I also don't care about spoilers, but it's intriguing to hear like all the positive vibes about it coming up. Cause to me, I'm always like, oh man, I don't know if Sandman, I'm like, kind of like, I don't know if this is a natural TV show, when I think back right? on it, of like, I could see the challenge of trying to like make it into that, like certainly not like a network television show where you have to divide things up in a sense, in a more like neat way.
I think Gaiman, and I think that's another part of the like serendipity of it is 30 years later, Neil Gaiman, maybe 30 years ago, he couldn't have done what he did, which was take it and adapt it and do it in a way where it's, 10 episodes, and he cut out some stuff and he mixed some stuff. But he got really the gist of all of it.
They were all the right changes.
Yeah. All the right.
Would you agree with that? Because you're reading it side by side with watching it, right, Sal?
I mean, basically, yeah.
You've watched it and you're refreshing yourself by going back and reading it. Yeah. And you're like, oh, okay, that's the change that they made. Merged these two characters or whatever.
It's sort of like almost like a different Neil Gaiman's adapting it. Because I was going to say, it's like sometimes the best thing for a work of fiction can be somebody who didn't write it is the one who's adapting it, because it's sort of like you can look at it with a less like beholden eye to like certain things and be like, okay, like this is the angle that this should take. I think of like The Shining with Stanley Kubrick, in comparison to the original Stephen King, of like, okay, like here's the source material that I enjoy, but like, what's my angle on it? So it's interesting because Neil Gaiman's someone who's had, he's had 30 years of making stuff to like hone that. So it is funny in a way to like have someone come back to something with the, all that experience of like, of making other things and like, being the one who's like, oh, okay, like maybe we should change this, or like actually to make this work, like maybe this is the way to do it.
Like, it's kind of like it's almost becomes a living document that's allowed to grow and change. And kind of dovetailing off that, one of the things I noticed about the comic and the TV show is that it's very referential to pop culture, both in different but equal kinds of ways. You know, it's he sneaks in, you know, a Cure Boys Don't Cry poster in the comic. And I'm just like, that is the perfect fucking record to listen to while you're reading Sandman in 1989, right?
Well, that's not a big stretch at that point. I mean,
right, yeah. Right.
Exactly. You can pick any Cure, Cult. You know, I mean, like,
yeah. I mean, but it's incredibly like referential of the era. And then the TV show has taken the neat trick that they've done is that they've kept, you know, the core message and vibe and feel, but it's transported to 2022 and it feels very natural. You know, they're equally as referential, but they hit the same notes.
Yeah, I didn't really, I don't know. I guess I wasn't really looking for pop culture references.
They're there. But it's
yeah. I didn't really make note of any of that stuff in the show, but it
you know, kind of they updated it, but did it in a way that felt very seamless. And that's, you know, kind of the whole point of what, you know, what makes a good adaptation. And Tom had kind of, we had chatted about this a little bit earlier in the day. And I think that's kind of the core of what makes a great comic adaptation is that you're given, you know, kind of free rein to change story structure, but as long as you keep the same tone and feel of it, I think that's what makes it a successful adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've talked about the fact that like Watchmen is a terrific, you know, scene by scene, page by page, sure, adaptation of the source material, but it doesn't make it a necessarily interesting movie.
Yeah,
or engaging one. Yeah, I think, and that, you know, that was one of the things that I found interesting about watching the show, and that I picked up more so than reading the comic, to a certain degree, was how, and I started to think about it, like compared to so many shows that are on TV now, is that Sandman is hopeful. It's yeah, ultimately it is a very, you know, sort of hopeful, positive, mm-hmm, show. And that's pretty rare these days. Like,
he's British, man. He grew up watching Doctor Who.
I knew Doctor Who. We should have put up Doctor Who pool.
Right. How many times is Chris going to bring up Doctor Who?
Doctor Who is a British sci-fi series that is at its core incredibly hopeful.
And boring.
That's fine. You can say that. It's fucking, you know, 1960s sci-fi. It looks fucking terrible. It's cheesy. It's ridiculous. But it's also hopeful. So there were a couple generations of nerds that loved it.
But I just found it sort of interesting, because it often gets talked about like it's, you know, this gothic. And mm-hmm, it is. It has a certain amount of goth element to it. And it has a certain amount, yeah, of the comic, especially, I think, is more so like,
oh,
it's darker. It's
emo little, before emo.
Yeah, it's just a darker sort of take on things. But at the heart of it, there is this sort of like, you know, this hope to it and this wonder and dream and what dreams are about. And, you know, everyone. And that was the thing, I think. Tom Sturridge does this amazing job of being the Sandman and being that aloof celestial being with a little bit of humanity to him, or at least trying to understand humanity, because he,
yeah,
is one of the few that respects the idea that, you know, as he says over and over again, we work for them. you know, that we are only here because of humans. We don't look down at them. We don't manipulate them. And that ultimately, the core of it is just sort of this sort of hopeful thing. And yeah. it was refreshing because so many shows are not that. I mean, if you look at, you know, even stuff like Lord of the Rings, it ultimately becomes heroic, but I don't know if it and, you know, like don't Game of Thrones is the antithesis. You know, Game of Thrones is all about sort mm-hmm. of the dark side of humanity, and there, you know, yeah. there isn't a whole lot of hope there. But this was like refreshing of like, there's this bit of wonder and hope and magic that Neil Gaiman has still all these years later. He still, and that's what I love about his writing, is that at the core of it, he's telling these sort of fairy tales, and they mm-hmm. are, they can be dark and they can be twisted and that, but at the yeah. end of the day, he seems like a very hopeful minded person, and it is refreshing in this day and age where so much, I think, television is not that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was actually mowing the grass today, thinking about this exact subject, and I had to phrase it or ask the question to you guys. It's like, Neil Gaiman, by all accounts, seems to be a pretty decent human being. Just, I don't know him personally, never met him. All I know is what you see through, you know, social media, that kind of stuff. Appears to be a good human being. Wow, is he able to write some dark fucking shit.
Oh, sure.
I mean, wow. What, that 24/7 episode and issue is some of the darkest fucking comics I've ever read in my life.
Yeah, it's, you know, and I will say this about that episode in particular. It really made me think about, like, the point of it. You know, the reading the comic, it's almost,
yeah.
especially originally when I read it back in the day, it was like, oh, this is, you know, fucked up and weird and oh my God. But then, like, watching the episode, and it's different because, you know, Dr. Destiny John, he's not the disfigured character that he is in the comic book.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, it made me think more about, like, why is he doing this? Like, why is he, what is his motivation behind yeah. this? Like, why? And I kind of came to the realization, it's like, well, that's the difference between him and the Sandman, is that he sees the world and he sees humanity as this cynical thing that mm-hmm. is, we're all lying to ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're all lying to each other. And his idea of utopia is stripping all that away and releasing who we really are.
Yeah. And, which, you know, we see the result of what happens.
We see the result of that.
Right.
And then you see, you know, what the Sandman, his once again, it's a much more positive, yeah. it's hopeful. And yeah. And has this belief in humanity, even though they, you know, we have darkness in us. It's almost, you know, the idea of what dreams are, you know, and that hope. The dreams are, I mean, you see it when he goes to hell. How does he defeat Lucifer? You know, hope.
With hope.
Yeah. You can't defeat. And yeah. that was just over and over and over again in the series of just
It's a very romantic
yeah.
view on life. And you know what? I need some of that in my life.
Yeah, it was. Well, that was right. the thing too. Just like yeah. at this point in time, it was an interesting, I guess, experience to kind of go through it and at the end of it, just be like, yeah, this was a really, you know, positive show. This was a really, you know, hopeful and just positive experience. And I wasn't left with dread. I wasn't left at the end of it sort of bemoaning humanity. It was, you know, the
like, why did I do this to myself?
Yeah, which yeah. And I think there's so many shows that are kind of like,
you didn't feel like a serial killer leaving the serial convention.
No, I did not feel like a serial killer the serial convention.
Yeah.
That was fucked
well,
up.
You know, like,
right? Right.
There's so many, you know, so especially I think the way entertainment has gone in the world of streaming and binge watching, where things have become like, I don't know. I think of Game of Thrones, and I think of like, it's like an example to me of like a story that's built purely on like that darkness of like feeding it to you, and like you being like, oh man, these guys are so bad. And then you kind of get to the end and you're kind of like, it ends essentially when you've run out of those things. And there's like, no, everyone's, you know, dead. Like, yeah. And it's sort of like, oh, okay. Like, you know, it can be, things can be very entertaining. Right. Yeah, I'm trying to think of some other examples of TV, you know, House of Cards. My wife used to watch it, and I used to joke and be like, there's like no sustenance to this. It is simply like,
it's popcorn,
like watching driven to
horrible
like
people
like in like whatever that switch is in your brain that's entertained by that, and like continually hitting that switch enough times that you just like binge watch it all in one day, and then you get to the end and you're like, okay, like
I'll watch Below Deck Med now. It's,
yeah,
because it's the same people. It's the same horrible people serving horrible people.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, nothing. I mean, I like those shows too, those type of shows too. But yeah, I mean, it can sometimes feel a little bit like your desire for watching bad people do bad stuff has been manipulated to like just to hit that switch over and over again with very little like, oh, like, that's interesting, or like, that's actually a thing that I would think about and not feel terrible, or like, this show actually has like not positivity, like in the sort of dumb, like everyone, like we should all love each other and like morning show positivity, but like a more like deeper level positivity about like the nature of people, you know, stuff that can kind of like hang with you for a longer time.
Well, even like, you know, the nature of death, and he does a whole episode on, you know, his sister, so death, good. and her job.
One of my favorite issues, one of my favorite episodes. Just so, so good.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's just another take on it. And he, you know, he's talked about like he didn't expect the effect that you know, that character would have on people's lives, and like how many people have come up to him over time, sort of like going, you know, that reading that issue, reading that character really helped me deal with the death of my father, the death of my mother, my brother, whoever, you know, and he, I guess he had a conversation with the actress, Kirby Howell Baptiste about it, and just going,
she's
hey,
awesome. She's
I want
awesome.
You to know this is going to put a sort of responsibility on you that you may not be prepared for. He's like, when you play this character, you may find that it affects other people, and that is a certain responsibility that comes with that. So be prepared that, you know, this may be something that changes your life. You know, just, you never know, you know, because it did it to him. Like it happened to him where he wasn't expecting that to sort of come with the idea of writing this issue and writing that character. And, you know, that character maybe became more popular than the Sandman, you know, you know, death became its own character, you know,
I would say the tattoo to tattoo ratio of death tattoos to Morbius tattoos, probably closer than you would think.
I don't know. Is that how we gauge popularity?
That's going to be for this. Yeah. Fuck it. That's my gauge of popularity. How many death tattoos versus how many Morbius tattoos are there in the world? I think it's a good barometer.
But I also think like it was funny to see this show also like come along at a time where you have like the ability to cast some really interesting, amazing geek culture icons in certain roles. Like you have, you know, whether it's Gwendolyn Christie, who became, you know, from Game of Thrones and Star Wars, like became this geek culture icon of an actress. And then, you know, Patton Oswalt as the Raven Matthew, you know, like
Mark Hamill
as Pumpkinhead, but even like Stephen Fry as Gilbert.
Oh, you know, like he was perfect for Gilbert. It was amazing.
But how serendipitous is that, that guy,
yeah,
exists and is like, you couldn't even pick a better person to play Gilbert. I don't think, you know, like he, you know, yeah. And so,
and you know that Gaiman and Stephen Fry know each other. It's you know it, that they've,
yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. Well, he had said, like, he talked about, once again, listen to the Marc Maron podcast with him on it. It's excellent, but it's not that long either. But he talked about how, you know, there were casting in some ways was difficult, but there were some things that were just completely no brainers. Like, it was just like, yeah, Stephen Fry, you're Gilbert. That's, you know, it's like Charles Dance, you're Roderick Burgess. Like, there's no, you know what I mean? Like, it's so simple in some ways. Yeah. And then there were people that were huge fans. I think it may have been Mason Alexander Park, who plays Desire, I believe was like a big Sandman fan and kind of an unknown actor that reached out to Gaiman on Twitter and was like, yeah, hey, have you cast Desire yet? Can I contact your casting agents? And ended up, you know, getting the part, but was a gigantic fan and wanted to be Desire, like really wanted to be
there. And was fucking Desire.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Although, yeah, the only complaint I have about him as Desire is that I didn't think he was that desirable. Like, you know, like, I mean, not even that because of what you might think of, but just like, you know, I not as a commentary on who they cast, but just like, I don't see it. I don't see the design. Like, I could see other actors, you know, in that role of being more desirable, not necessarily, but was very good. You know,
yeah, it's not sexy enough for you.
The only, yeah, I mean, just not in any, not.
It wasn't enticing at all. But I think it was more, definitely, I mean, for the character to be the
wickedness, evil, a certain wickedness and an androgyny.
Yeah, it's like wicked desire, you know? It's,
yeah. The only complaint I had was from all the changes in the show, you know, whether it was, you know, different races playing different, which, you know, whatever, who gives a shit?
I don't think it impacted the story, and that's why I think it's a really good adaptation. They updated it. There's certainly more people of color in primary roles, and
none of that matters to the story. It doesn't affect this. Yeah,
it doesn't change the story at all. But that's good. You know,
the only thing I kind of would complain about was the fact that of all the changes you make, and, you know, let's be honest, there's some very kind of like progressive changes to some characters, that kind of thing.
Yeah, sure.
But Despair is still just sort of a fat Walmart, you know, bumpy white lady.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, you couldn't, you know, it's like, that's Despair. Someone who's fat is Despair. It's like, okay, I guess fat people still.
Yeah.
You know,
I think you pegged it. Fat white Walmart shopper.
Yeah,
that stereotype is okay.
That's I guess that one's fine. So
yeah,
that was a little interesting. Out of all the changes, all the sort of like, you know, kind of progressive things that they do, you know, because you read the comic and it is, you know, it is 99% white people in that book. I mean, I don't even know.
Hey, dude, it's British. It's very, very fucking British. 99% of the people creating the comic are British. Yeah.
Yeah. No. No.
But, you know, and that's not because I doubt that Gaiman was like, I'm not going to put many minorities in my comic because whatever reason. It's like, no, that he was writing what he knew.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever. I mean, it was terrific. Everybody in the show was terrific.
What How do you like Corinthian? Jesus.
That, well, he's great. I mean, I've liked that actor, you know, for a while now. And, you know, I love, though, that it Nailed felt it. Like he did a great job of always talking with his teeth. He always had, like, you know what I mean? Like, he was always sort of had those teeth out in every scene.
Yeah, there's always, and making, obviously, referencing his, yeah. his eyes. Yeah, fucking creepy. Goddamn creepy. And awesome.
Yeah, he was great. And you know, he's an interesting character, too, because, you know, as much as he's the kind of the villain in it, you know, you also get the sense of, like, you know, Dream is not perfect. He's not a perfect ruler. He's no. not without flaws, and he's made mistakes, and, you know, getting trapped and locked up for 100 years, 120 years, whatever it was, it sort of showed some of that. It's, you know, the cracks in him as a king, as a ruler, as a person, if you will, also, you know, just the way he treated Lucienne, the way that he treated some of the dreams that he created, the nightmares, and the way that he looked at nightmares as almost fodder to some degree, or tools to use, as opposed to also creatures with their own sense of identity. And you know, and it almost reminded me, I can't remember the one character, the one nightmare, the sort of blue
Jed's guardian angel,
basically. Yeah, what the hell, it's, anyway, like, I can't think of her name, but you know, when she sort of was kind of making her last attempt to live and arguing with him about it, it reminded me of, like, Wreck-It Ralph, of, like, hey, I'm a bad guy, but that doesn't make me a bad guy. You know, like yeah. you know, it's yeah. like, you made me a villain, but that doesn't mean that's all I am, you know? Yeah. And so
it was interesting. And it gets into the whole concept of character development, you know, of being able to change. And that's, in a weird way, that's kind of that undercurrent theme over at least this first, you know, couple arcs, is that, you know, we see character development of Dream. He starts as a kind of silent, stoic, literally, monolithic deity. But then we actually, over the course of these episodes and issues, see him develop emotions and feelings, and the episode and issue of what's the character, the immortal character, I can't remember his name, like Bod Goskins or whatever, the guy that he sees every 100 years.
Oh yeah, I can't remember his name off the top of my head.
Yeah,
Hob something. It's Hob.
Hob. Yeah, and that. Episode and issue, I mean, that was all about Morbius developing or recognizing his humanity in a weird way, right?
Yeah, or at least his connection to humanity.
Right, yeah, Hobbs. Thank you, Philip.
Yeah, I wonder if it's, you know, I was thinking about it too, like, you know, we don't really know Dream before he gets captured, but you think, like, you know, 120 years of sort of just sitting there contemplating, you know, does it, you know, is that what sort of sent him, what started to change him?
Oh, it has to be, right?
Well, I don't know, because it's like, he's immortal, so is 120 years anything to him?
Yeah.
Well, but the changes don't start until after he has to reclaim his tools.
His loss. He has loss, right? And then
he has loss, exactly. Yeah. He's not the, you know, he's not the endless. He's vulnerable.
Yeah, and he has to, you know, but I wonder if it's more, you know, just sort of after the fact, you know, his kingdom is destroyed, all of his subjects have fled, his tools are missing, he's experienced, now he's and you know, the dream world has been screwed up, the real world has been screwed up, and he has to go on this, and he talks about it in the one episode with his sister, with Death, about like he had a purpose after that. And he, you know, it made him feel good to have a purpose. But then once it was done, once his quest was over, and I started to think like, is this just Gaiman figuring out what to do with this character when he's writing that? Like,
oh, going, absolutely. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't know what to do with this guy. And it's like, well, I don't know what to do with my life. What do I do with my life now? And almost like that's the issue where he kind of figured out what to do with that.
Well, that was the whole, they're not here for our amusement. We are here to serve them.
Yeah.
That's the, that is like watershed moment for Dream where he realizes that he's not a deity. He's a servant.
Yeah. It's an interesting, you know, take on just, you know, the idea of gods and heaven, because there's obviously a heaven and a hell. There's a hell, so there must be a heaven. There, you know, and they mention the creator and God and a few times.
I don't know who the prodigal is, so that's one mystery that they drop that I'm looking forward to finding out. I haven't Googled it because I'm not that guy.
Just read the comics.
Yep, exactly. I want it to be revealed organically.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really loved the series. You know, there was maybe one episode in it that I thought was a little drawn out or a little boring. Maybe going back to what Tom was saying of just like, it's a little, just a lot of exposition. But for the most part, I really loved every episode.
Which one?
Does it look
trying good? To think. I'm trying to guess. If I had him in front of me, I could guess.
It looks amazing. I mean, it looks terrific.
Sometimes Netflix.
The hell episode?
You know.
No, they definitely didn't spare any money on it. And he even talked about, like, people think a lot of it is CGI. That's not. They actually built amazing sets to use and that kind of thing. And I wouldn't even say that. I mean, there is CGI in it, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's, I would almost say it's like unobtrusive CGI. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't like take
it's
over.
Not like, oh, look at this.
I don't feel like it. Yeah.
The Cain and Abel and Gregory.
You're still wondering. I don't know if I want to tell you which episode it was.
Because first of all, everyone knows, or anyone who knows me knows my deep love for dogs and our pit bulls. And that fucking Gregory episode had me crying big old giant man tears. And it was, God damn you, Neil Gaiman, for making me weep like that.
No, it wasn't that episode. It was later on. I think it was maybe episode 7 or 8.
So one of the Rose episodes.
Yeah. I just found it to sort of just drag on a bit, and it was kind of boring and not a whole lot I thought interesting was going on in it. But I don't, I don't know if it was 7 or 8.
Yeah.
I think it might have been 8.
I'm glad to hear it looks good because.
Oh, it looks amazing.
Because let's be honest, you could imagine a Sandman TV show that looks sort of trite and embarrassing, you know, like because those character designs that are within the comic, you could see them come to life in like the most expected ways that are sort
it's very natural.
You're gonna be happy.
It's very naturalized, the costume designs and you know he doesn't overdo the hair, he doesn't overdo I mean, it's even interesting, like
the dude who plays Morbius is almost a little too pretty. He doesn't have much grit to him, but he does angry well, I think. Which that character needs to do angry well.
Really? I don't know if I consider him that angry.
It's kind of like when your mom was really mad at you. It's like it didn't happen very often, but when it did, it was fucking, you know, serious time.
I think he does intense and aloof extremely well, which that character is a very intense character, very serious character for the most part. And it, and it's wonderful when, you know, you might go 9 episodes before he smiles.
Right. But
when he does, then, he, you know, a little tiny smile, it's like, oh, there is some humanity there, because he does such a great job of this sort of aloof king. Yet you always get the feeling that that's a bit of an act, that behind that, the real Morpheus is not, you know, he's putting on a bit of an act the whole time.
Would that maybe be Neil Gaiman?
I would imagine.
Right.
Yeah. It, especially when he was younger. I don't know about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's probably still in late 20s.
Yeah.
Goth kid from England. Yeah. It's.
But no, I don't think, I mean.
Death in my comic book.
You get enough. You get enough of character designs, but it's not like over the top. I mean, you know, it's pretty well done.
Yeah, because I was like, when I heard they were making a Sandman TV show, I was like, ugh, it's on Netflix. I was like, the convergence of Netflix sometimes, like, I don't even think it's like a cheapness thing. I think it's just sort of like a carelessness to aesthetics sometimes, where it's just sort of like, like, it's just like, this looks kind of like not great. Like, it just kind of looks like.
Really? Looks, I don't like what.
Sometimes. What, you know, like it pops up. It pops up in stuff like, God. You know, the most egregious one was. The trial of the Chicago 7.
Oh,
where I was like, this is a really expensive movie that I'm like, this looks like costumes pulled out of a box. Like the way people were dressed was very like
I don't remember.
Yeah,
I did watch it.
Wasn't it? It was like a combination
going in that.
Yeah, it was like the combination of like, but it's not just like clothing. It's a combination of like lighting and like all these things where you're like, this looks like not quite right. Like it looks like a little, and I mean, I think some of that too is like the elements of like, you know, we've talked about, you know, not enough CGI artists. I think there's probably not enough experienced cinematographers.
Joe G brings up a good one. Jupiter's Legacy.
Yeah, because it's like not a cheapness thing. Like it's not like they didn't spend enough money on things. It's just like everyone's like,
no, like, no, I get you. Like the Chicago 7, it's almost like they're cosplaying as 70s.
Yeah, there's like a weird, like, it's like you kind of didn't light it right and you kind of didn't quite pick the right stuff, and it's like kind of looks costumey and like, but yeah, it's not cheap, you know, like it's like,
but do you think that's a Netflix, I mean, that's not certainly a Netflix like sole thing.
No,
I think
I think it's an effect that Netflix puts out like a tremendous amount of stuff,
right?
Like
they've slowed down a little bit. It's not like Netflix 4 years ago, where it was just like it was a fire hose of Netflix originals. I think it's kind of what we were talking about earlier, Tom, that spigot is being turned off. And I think they're becoming more and more selective about what they're creating.
I just don't think anyone can play Abby Hoffman without it looking like a Halloween party. Like you can't dress like Abby Hoffman and not look like you're wearing a costume.
I liked the movie. I was like, this is a pretty good movie. But there's a couple of scenes where I was like how the cops were dressed up. I was like, this is like how you would dress up cops in like if I was doing a like improv show as opposed to like you know, like
I don't know, man. I think you may not be giving credit to how bad fashion was in the 1970s and
fashion was in the 70s.
Yeah.
I was also like, this movie takes place in three places. Like, it's like there's not that many settings. And I was like, this is unfair to now we've gone off into a totally different topic. But have you guys ever?
Well,
I was talking about, like, at the same time where I watched that, like the next weekend, I watched, have you watched Small Axe on Amazon Prime? It's by the director Steve I forget what it's, Small Axe. Now I gotta look up all the names. By Steve McQueen, the director. So it's like a director named Steve McQueen. Yeah, he did like the other stuff that he's done. He's British. Steve McQueen. Well, anyway, there's an episode that kind of like took place at the same time about like not, it also took place in like like a trial, and you know, the director Steve McQueen is like a fucking just like next level, like as far as aesthetics. And I probably was like, I probably unfairly compared Aaron Sorkin, who obviously does not give a fuck about aesthetics. And it's just like, how many words can I have people say to each other? You know, like Aaron Sorkin doesn't strike me as the type of person who's like a director who's like meticulously like designing like what the courtroom looks like. And like Steve McQueen is more of like the, someone's only going to say like five words in this 15 minutes. And we're going to spend like a tremendous amount of time making like this room look fucking like sick. Right. So like neither one is good nor bad. Just like Steve McQueen did 12 Years a Slave. He did Widows. He did, and Small Axe is awesome. If you've never seen Small Axe on Amazon Prime, you should watch it. It's pretty rad. They're like awesome. They're like, it's a series of five kind of movies, almost like some are movie length, some are like 40 minutes long, about like the experience of like West Indies people in the UK, you know, like in the 70s and 80s, and like different, based on different like true events. And it's pretty awesome. It's pretty rad. So I probably unfairly compared Aaron Sorkin's design aesthetic to,
I don't know, man. I'm looking at pictures from the court scenes of both of these movies. I don't see anything different in either one.
You gotta watch the movie. You gotta watch them though. Like it's all about like, well, anyway, I won't go into my Aaron Sorkin criticisms.
I don't know. I'll have to look at those.
You should just watch Small Axe because it's really good anyway.
Well, that's a different story. I mean,
so. Yeah. Well worth your time.
But I think it was a pretty fantastic adaptation, which brings up the idea of sort of like, what other adaptations have you guys? There's been some good ones, some terrible ones. Mm-hmm. Comic book adaptations. I mean, obviously, all the Marvel movies aside, I don't think
they created Marvel their own universe. Yeah. But you know, I look at stuff like Ghost World or History of Violence. You know, it's like History of Violence is interesting because I think that the graphic novel is great, and the movie is a really fantastic movie. But they are
very different,
wildly fucking different from each other. And so where does that fall into the, it's a good adaptation debate? It's because both, it's a good source material. It's a good finished product as a movie, but they're so different that, you know, does that change how you think about it, you know, an adaptation?
Because
we talk about like Watchmen.
No, I certainly. I mean, I don't. I think people do. I mean, I guess it's a weird thing. Like, if you're a huge fan, I mean, why are adaptations made? Because there's already a fan base of right. something popular, right? A book, a comic, whatever it may
good,
be.
There is already a good idea.
But then if you're a fan, if you're a tremendous fan of something like, say, Stephen King's The Shining, and you go and see Stanley yeah, Kubrick's The Shining, you may be very disappointed. It may be difficult for you to necessarily get over the fact that it's so wildly different. Yes, it's amazing in its own right, but it's so wildly different than what I was expecting going in.
Or if you're the reverse and you love as perhaps I'm talking about myself, who loved the movie and then read the Stephen King one, and you're like, oh, okay, I guess they were definitely were ghosts. You know, like, right? It's like a very different,
yeah. literal, yeah.
different, yeah, like such a not, yeah, like a non-nuanced, like, oh, this is very, like, that's very extremely different. Like, I know, I always think about, like, you know, like American Splendor isn't necessarily like what I would call a straight up, like, adaptation of something, right? But like, what yeah. I think it is, mm-hmm. is like, what I like about it is it like captures a point of view, right? Like, in its own way, it captures like the point of view of those comics, like,
right? Sure,
in a absolutely. Different way, like, where it's like, without being necessarily like, certainly some of it is an adaptation, but some of it isn't, you know, it's not, like some of it's extemporaneous, you know, to the actual comics. But I always think about that one of like, it's like, if you can take the point of view, and it doesn't, it's weird because I'm like, I don't even necessarily know you have to maintain the same point of view. Like, because I think about the Shining is the same as the example, right? Of like, I think The Shining is like a pretty awesome adaptation because mm-hmm. it kind of like has its own point of view in a way, which I think could be a criticism or like a strength of an adaptation of like being able sure. to like take something and like put like such a different view. Like, you can't look at that source material the same way after seeing the movie, and whether it's a good or bad way. You know, I think about Doom Patrol, about how Doom Patrol changed the way I kind of looked at the Morrison comics.
Yeah.
Like
Umbrella Academy.
Umbrella
Academy did the same thing for me.
Actually, Doom Patrol, the Morrison comics are really funny. And
right?
like, I always thought that they were, or in my mind, I was like, oh, these are like these complex, like esoteric. And it's like, oh, wait, no, actually, like, it's kind of a joke. It's kind of funny. You're supposed to like think of these things as like not being very serious. Where in my like young adult mind, I was like, these are very serious. He's saying some very serious things.
Right. Very deep.
Very deep. And it's like, oh, wait, no.
No,
like,
it's a fart joke.
Yeah, it's a joke. It's like it's not serious. Like, you're not supposed to be taking it that seriously. Or like, you certainly couldn't. So it was like very illuminating in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think when I was younger, I probably had a harder time accepting adaptations that weren't, mm-hmm. you know, literal or weren't faithful to the subject matter. But as I've gotten older, I almost enjoy, like you said, a different perspective maybe on it, or, you know, at least yeah. I give it a certain, I give it more of a chance, but.
Starship Troopers, baby.
Yeah. I enjoy the movie way more than I enjoy the book.
Right.
I'll watch that movie.
But
that, you know, that is a wild adaptation.
Yes.
It's like, damn, you know, like to read that source material.
Right.
And your reaction to be sort of like, fuck this. Like,
and that was literally
yeah.
I remember reading an interview with him about it, and he's like, they asked him, well, why did you deviate from the source material so much? He's like, well, why the fuck would I want to make that movie?
Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, why would I make that? Yeah. Like, such a wild, like, you know what? Like, I actually think the source material is worth kind of making fun of.
Yeah.
And I sort of disagree with the philosophy behind it. So I'm
going to talk about subversion. You know, like, yeah. talk about that's subversion right there. Like, I'm gonna get the budget to make an adaptation of this book, but I'm gonna make it by, you know, poking holes in it you know, and yeah, and, which I love. That's, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, so, it's a novel movie.
It's a think piece. I mean, the novel, you know, whatever you know, I think of it as kind of like, you know, Atlas Shrugged or, you know, Fountainhead. It's a think piece, and there's a philosophy behind it, and yeah, it's.
Yeah, it's to take that and be like, okay, like,
yeah,
it's that if let's expand this philosophy behind this book all the way out, and like, let's like, is the like, and sort of, you know, be like, look how ridiculous this is, look how weird yeah. this is.
Oh,
and,
like, wow, I never fucking thought of it like that.
Oh, yeah, he's absolutely like,
oh, I never
burning the like idea. That.
That's cool.
You know,
of like
patriotism, oh, like, and gymnastic thought, and the idea of like
earning citizenship.
Yeah.
Yeah. And be like, well, look at that, what that makes you in the end.
Right.
You know, where it's like,
this is the society you create when you fetishize war.
Yeah.
And which is what we do as a country, you know, like we,
what?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, I just remember, oh, yeah, that's another good example of it. I read the source material, and I was like, wait a second.
Right? Like, yeah.
This is a lot, like, oh, like, this dude meant that. Robert Heinlein, like, having seen the movie, it was funny because it made me think of the movie totally, where I always enjoyed the movie because I thought it was kind of like, it was just like kind of a cool action movie that had like really cool fight scenes and like, but it had like a weird campiness that I couldn't quite figure out, you know, like where it was coming from of like what. And then I was like, oh, he's like making fun of, like, he's like, I get where the campiness is coming from. He's like, hey, if you're somebody who believes in this stuff, like, this is like,
you're a fucking, you know, idiot.
Yeah, like the weird football scenes where they're playing that weird version, like where it's
the anti Top Gun movie. You know what I mean? Like, look at it compared to it's like, it's almost a response. I mean, granted, it's like a decade later, but you know, it's almost like a response to a movie like fucking Top Gun. You know, which is like that was the weird thing. Like, I had so many friends that were so excited about the new Top Gun movie. And I was like, I don't really fucking care. Like, I don't really give a fuck about, you know, a bunch of douchebag pilots.
The first Top Gun movie wasn't like a good movie. Yeah.
Like, but I'm just like, I don't I'm not in love with like the idea of fighter pilots. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not, you know what I mean? Like, I don't really give a fuck, you know, about that kind of shit, but it's like, people are so excited about Top Gun, you know, it's like,
I've had like,
give me a
Starship Trooper. Million people ask me, have you seen Maverick yet? I was like, no.
I've heard it's good. I read a review where someone was like, what happens when you make a sequel to a movie that's not a good movie and you've actually made a good movie? And in the second one, where it was sort of like, it was like a more serious, like,
don't get me wrong.
Oh.
In 1980, whatever the fuck, when Top Gun came out, I was all about Top Gun. No question.
Oh, yeah, it's just
now, all the, you know, it's like,
no, I just last time you, have a lot you watched, of homoeroticism.
Have you watched Top Gun lately? I watched it 2 years ago because it was on TV.
We watched it. My extended
family was like,
here the last weekend and they watched it. And I was like, oh my God, this is legit a gay movie.
I was like, this is not good. Like, no, this is
awful.
Like it's sort of doesn't make any sense. Like, I kind of don't understand really why any of these things are happening. Like, it's so, you know, I was about to make a joke about reading the Top Gun novel, the source material. The great source material, the Top Gun, the great adaptations of our times.
Wildly different.
Wildly different.
I mean, for me, it's just like, I guess the realization, you know, but these guys are training to murder people. I'm not really into that necessarily as, you know, like, go Maverick, go learn how to kill people better. Yay.
Yeah.
You know, like, in this day and age, I'm just sort of like, I don't really give a fuck.
Feelings.
Gotta kill the bugs, man. Gotta kill them bugs.
You gotta kill the bugs.
Yeah, just that scene at the end when they're all celebrating, like, capturing the bug. And, like, you know, like, it's so, like, subversively, like, ugh, like, this is not good.
I love, like, all the like, you know, promos, all the commercials, the pro-military commercials.
Yeah, the news reel,
citizenship. Like, they're so fucking brilliant. Just those commercials alone that they did. Are just so wonderfully subversive and brilliant, you know.
I might have to watch that movie again. It's been years since I watched it. I love how our Sandman discussion has turned into a love letter about fucking Starship Troopers.
Starship Troopers. It's great adaptations.
All right, let's go. Like, I'm going to go. I want some quick responses to adaptations, what you thought.
Okay.
Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Great.
Oh, I liked it.
Loved Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yeah, it was terrific. Rad. It was like, got the point of view. Yeah,
he gave us Brie Larson.
Not everything's perfect. Road to Perdition.
Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read the comic. The movie's probably more entertaining than the comic.
Fantastic soundtrack. Fantastic fucking soundtrack.
The Crow. Adaptation.
Yeah, I was some mopey emo guy.
It's never a big
great soundtrack.
Never a big
great soundtrack.
Great soundtrack. Yeah, most movies have pretty good soundtracks, Chris.
But The Crow, fantastic soundtrack. That's a great Cure song.
Now, what do you think of the adaptation of The Crow to the wrestler Sting?
Oh, that's one of the best adaptations.
Jesus.
Kick Ass.
Which one?
Kick Ass.
Yes.
Yeah. Thumbs up.
It's all right.
Yeah. Right? Well, I mean, it's like, it's as much as I kind of liked the comic. Yeah. I guess, like, the only thing I would be like, though, is that the art of the comic was such a big draw that, like, once you take the art away, I'm sort of like, okay. Like, this is fine. Like, it's a fine movie.
30 Days a Night.
Ooh. Oh, good pick.
God, I can't remember anything about the movie.
I like the movie.
I like the movie too.
Yeah, I like the movie. Yeah, it was good.
It's
good
faded into the recesses of my brain.
Hellboy.
Which one?
Any of them. Do you like any of them?
I liked the first Ron Perlman movie a lot.
I liked it too. I
the rest, they kind of go downhill progressively, and then the massive downward spiral with the last one.
I don't think there's a whole one that I like. There's pieces of all of them that I like where I'm like, oh, that's cool. Yeah. But it's like a actual like movie. Yeah. Like, I don't think any of them are actually that.
Yeah.
You know, I know people have a lot of love for the Guillermo del Toro ones, you know, but like, even to me, those, I'm kind of like,
I think back in the day, you may have made the description of them as a really high budget fan film.
It's like, they kind of like, they're all okay.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm never like dying to watch them. Like, if they're on, I'll watch it till there's a commercial or something. And then I'm immediately
There were some Hellboy cartoons that, and I've got them on DVD or something over there, that came out about the same time and were way better than the movies.
All right, now we're going to go down.
I mean, the comics are so unique. You know what I mean? Both, like, in the way the stories are told. And we've talked about this before, how, like, the thing that's cool about Hellboy is, like, the comics are sort of detached from, like, linear storytelling. Like, you kind of just, like, you're never quite sure. like you can kind of get dropped in wherever, you know, like this Hellboy story takes place here and this takes place then. And then like, which sort of defies movie, like the way our brains want to like order movies. Like this is the first one. And then this is the sequel that happens afterwards. And this is a prequel, you know, like the Hellboy universe doesn't quite work that way. Like you just kind of like
get dropped. You can nerd your way to that in the Hellboy universe.
But I'm sure you can.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a fucking timeline, but that's the
between websites that
you
dedicated
can just drop a story in wherever you want. Do what?
There's websites dedicated to timeline.
All right, yeah,
the reading order and Constantine.
The
Keanu Reeves.
The Keanu Reeves one. Yeah, it was fine.
I don't know. That's another one where I'm like, I saw it. Can't tell you a fucking thing about it other than
Tilda Swanson was in it.
Okay, now we're gonna go with all of the Frank Miller movies. The Spirit.
Oh no.
I think The Spirit is like impossible to adapt. How do you adapt that?
Right.
You can't. Yeah. It's just like it doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work
that way. Like it's like
Sin City.
Ooh, that's a tough one because God damn it, if you're gonna adapt Sin City, that's what it should look like. But
I have to say I like the Sin City movies. Yeah. At least the first one, the second
one. You know, the only thing about them I have a hard time. I think I would have liked them better if they were like a TV show. Or like they were smaller chunks. Like,
right.
I guess I find myself like
15-minute webisodes.
Like when you're in that heavy, when you're in that such strong aesthetic, like I actually kind of like, I feel like my brain gets kind of worn out, like being in that space for like movie length times. Like I just like, I don't know. Like I have a hard time. I like enjoy them for a period of time. And then it's almost like my brain sort of like, checks out. Like
would you have like a Black Mirror format where
I don't know, like
an episode just, maybe 7 minutes or 40 minutes?
It's to be honest, I had the same reaction to 300 where I'm like,
okay,
I'm always like, oh okay, like this is like I like this is cool, but it's almost like my eye, like something in my brain gets like bored of it, like of like this look, you know, as opposed to like, which is funny because or like whatever it is. But when I see it in chunks, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, this is cool. Like I'm digging this. But I think that's purely a subjective.
That's fair.
Like my own brain.
I think 300 though is probably the best adaptation of any of Frank Miller's.
Probably.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
It's.
I think you're right.
It's. I mean, it's very close to the source material, but it's also, I mean, it was wildly popular in its own thing. Like it transcended the comic book, you know, huge. I mean, that was a big movie.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. To flip this around, what Frank Miller work would you still like to see adapted? I think there's an obvious answer, but
I mean, I think Ronin would be cool.
That's the obvious answer, right?
But I don't know how. I mean, I think I feel like it's kind of been adapted in parts in so many movies, and
it's so influential.
Yeah,
so many other.
Well, not only that, it's not just influential. It's also derivative of stuff.
Yeah.
It's hard when it's like both,
right?
Or it's like so many other things.
The fifth element.
But then also when you see it, you're like, well, also when you read the source material, you're like, oh, I get where this comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Like you exist in that, which
actually
like, a lot of great comics come from that, you know, where it's like, I very clearly see what this thing is like born from. And I very clearly see what came from it. And like,
actually the,
not bad. That's how it works. Yeah.
Actually the book that I think you could make a really cool series out of would be Hard Boiled.
Oh, fuck yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because honestly, there's not much story there.
Well, I mean, you're just telling a detective stories. You can do a series with that character.
Right. There's a lot of room to make that whatever you want.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing about 300 is like Zack Snyder's aesthetic and like Frank Miller's aesthetic kind of lined up nicely.
Right? Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, like Zack Snyder's approach was like captured that Frank Miller point of view, right? Whereas you
can see peanut butter and jelly.
Like when you see, it's like, as opposed to Watchmen, where you're like, I don't know if you got Watchmen. He definitely got 300. He got they're in line. Yeah. Like
a bunch of oiled up, muscle bound dudes fighting each other. That's a pretty, you know, like that's right up his alley.
But like that is, in the aesthetic of like the power, you like physically show the power.
I don't think Zack Snyder does a whole lot of subtext.
No.
But, you know, like tapping into that element of that, of like, actually, we're going to emphasize. Yeah, like there, you cannot go too far in making these guys like
super macho.
You do not need to make them nuanced. Like there is no nuance. Like they are like, you know,
where I think, monolith.
Yeah, and that's what makes like it's like, but with that style and that story, it's kind of like a perfect melding of that. Whereas like you take it away from that type of that story and you are, you know, like Watchmen, right? And you're kind of like, I think you're missing maybe some of the nuance of like what's happening here. Like where it's just like, yes, we will also just like, yeah, fuck yeah. Like
Watchmen the movie is basically if someone made a movie about a comic book without actually reading the dialogue and just looked at the pictures. I think that's what Zack Snyder does. I think he just looks at the pictures and makes movies. That's, all right. Well, speaking of Alan Moore, what about other than Watchmen? What about like From Hell? Mm. Terrible, awful.
I mean, just let's just say Alan Moore adaptations. Mm. Has there been a good?
How about V for Vendetta?
That's probably the best.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that's a really good example too of a movie where like. I think they didn't necessarily have the same point of view as Alan Moore did. Like Alan Moore's point of view is much more anarchist and much more where I think
V for Vendetta is a bit,
but I think much more pointed at like, I don't know, I guess it depends, right? You could say Alan Moore's was pointed at a very specific thing happening, you know, which is, you know, Thatcher,
right,
in, 80s, you know, 80s, like 80s Britain politics, and like sort of the fear of like, oh, this is where fascism come, you know, is born, and like it's from these things, and this is where you, when you play that out all the way to the end of like,
but I think the movie
you end up with,
I think
the movie sticks to that in a nice way, like it's still born of that.
To ask, kind of go back to the same question. If there's an Alan Moore property that you think still has the ability to be, you know, a good, you know, adapted property, what would you like to see? Which one would you point at and say, oh, yeah, that's what I want to see, either as a movie or a series?
Well, I think as a series, top 10.
Yes.
For sure. Someone should make that into a series. Like it's built. It's a police procedural where everyone has superpowers. Like that should be easy. It doesn't, it's not particularly deep. It's not, I mean, there are nuance to it, but it's like, you could just do that straight. And, you know, literally the Marvel Universe meets, you know, NYPD Blue. Like that's what it is. And it's just like, there you go. That's a show for sure. That if you're gonna do one, I still think, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Done correctly.
Could be done well if you did that well, and not as you know, sort of campy as they did it. I think
less X2 and more Doom Patrol.
I don't know if that's the aesthetic I would go for necessarily.
Not all the way there, but you know, it's got to be.
I think it would benefit from sort of like the modern, like if you made a TV show out of it, like not having to be like, what is this? Is this like a, who's the hero? Who's like the like two-fisted man of action? Who, you know, like the sort of problems with the movie version where it's sort of like, we have to add this character as like the hero and we have to do, you know, like thinking about that, you know, adapting, you know, making a comic book movie at that time of like all the sort of problems of the movie of like trying to make it fit sort of like a certain type of story that's an action movie.
Did you guys did you ever watch the show Penny Dreadful?
Yes.
I mean, that's essentially the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. It's such, I mean, that's obviously derived from League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah. That's more the tone that I would look for as opposed to the movie, which we were talking about James Robinson last week. And don't bring that subject up.
Oh, the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Yeah.
He wrote the, I think he did the screenplay.
But even Penny Dreadful, I think, is a little too creature feature in tone. I would almost like, you know, bring it back, like almost push it more towards Indiana Jones and less, you know, kind of like Elvira or, you know what I mean? Or creature features.
More like the serial. You know, like you said.
I mean, all those characters are like man of action, you know, serial kind of stuff. Not all. I mean, you certainly
there's always the underlying ribbon of camp to it.
Yeah, but I think I would get rid of that.
I think that's important. It's even in the Alan Moore and O'Neill comic, there was always the under ribbon of camp and how they would introduce characters and all of the Easter eggs. It was, you know, it was kind of like a fun, you know.
Yeah, but I think that's what makes it silly. I think it what turns it into silliness. You didn't, you know, if you look at Indiana Jones, there's
silliness in Indiana Jones,
but not campiness. I wouldn't say that there's camp. There's much camp, and not in the best parts of Indiana Jones.
Movie. Yeah,
it's not campy. It's you know, it has a nostalgia for those serial and those period.
Yeah, it's almost like Brave New World or Strange New Worlds is nostalgic for the old Star Trek. You know, but it's not campy.
It's right? not camp. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Is that kind of.
Yeah, I think once you start going into camp with that, it's going to turn into, I mean, it's so easy to turn the idea of like these literary characters banding together. It's a very campy premise.
Yeah, sure.
So I think as soon as you turn that switch on, it then it becomes less serious and less, it just becomes silly. It just becomes
Has less weight.
Yeah, sure. I think so. I think then you're, that's what the movie did wrong. It was campy. I think
you need to turn up the thing about the comic is while there's that camp thread through it, there's also like a threat of violence that's always like something awful can happen, you know, and it turns quickly, you know, where like, oh, actually this like horrible thing could happen. And like the Invisible Man is awful. He's like, could do something terrible. And Mr. Hyde's, so there's always the threat of something like genuinely sinister would be like the word that I would use to it.
There's always tension in that book.
Yeah, where you have to almost if you made an adaptation of it, like turn up the sinisterness.
Well, compare
more of like
compare the Invisible Man the movie to the Invisible Man the book. You know, like speaking of adaptations, it's like those are very different things. And you know, it's like the Invisible Man in the book, I mean, it's an affliction. You know what I mean? Like it's this sickness, it's a psychosis that it ends up being, where in the movie they touch on that, but it's also like this silliness and it's more about the special effects. And it's like, I think with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, it's like you play it straight. Yes, mm-hmm. this is the daughter of Frankenstein. This is Jekyll and Hyde. These are all these
ridiculous,
but play it straight. You know that it's silly. Play it straight, and I think it would come off better. Whereas in the movie, they went with the kind of funny, silly campiness of it, kind of shitty movie.
Yeah, it's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles at its best. It's a serious comic that just happens to be based around four, you know, mutated turtles.
Yeah, I don't know if that analogy holds weight.
No, but no,
TMNT is Superman. We'll do League of Extraordinary Gentlemen right after Ooh. That. That'll be our next time. We're just going to read the modern classics, our modern canon of classics.
I'm up.
Now I want to reread it because I haven't read it in a while. Actually, I would.
Well, whose pick is it after All-Star Superman? Is that Chris's pick?
I think
pick?
It's Chris's.
No, did I pick All-Star Superman?
I picked All-Star Superman, I think.
Yeah. Just like, fuck it. We're just like, let's do All-Star Superman. Whatever. Yeah. Which, by the way, if we're talking about, I was reading it the other day, and one of the issues did make me cry. The one with where his dad passes away, where I'm like, Grant Morrison, you son of a bitch.
You got me.
You know, damn it.
All right. I feel like we could talk for another hour and a half about Sandman, even just the first season and the first couple arcs.
I don't think we could. I'm done talking.
You're done.
Yeah. It's like, I'm done.
So we're not going to do that. So we'll wrap things up here. A reminder that if you want to get more Around Comics content, you can do that by helping us out as a patron. You can do that at patreon.com/Around Comics. And you get to hear me and Sal, and sometimes me and Sal and Tom and other guests talk about TV and movies on ACTV. We got some Tom Versus.
Well, I got some stuff to talk about.
Oh,
yeah.
I got
What We Do in the Shadows, the last episode.
The wedding episode.
I was fucking crying. I was laughing so hard. That show has become so fucking ridiculous.
Right. Marta and I were talking about it tonight, where it's like, you know what? They know that they have a dedicated fan base, so they have no fucks to give. And they're just, it is 120 miles an hour straight ahead. It's like, hold on. Here we go.
Beautiful.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. I love that show so much. It was like, if it wouldn't have been, it was almost midnight when I finished watching that episode. I wanted to just watch it again. Right. I laughed so much at it. Well, we'll talk about it on Sunday. Remind me, I have to ask you something about that episode when we talk about it on Sunday, because I have a question and I want to see how you felt about it. Remind me to ask you.
Okay. I mean, it's some of the best TV on right now. So we'll talk about that on ACTV, which you can listen to if you are a patron. Which we also have, speaking of patron-only shows, we have K-Billy Super Sounds. What about 2 weeks from now? We're going to start our month of celebration of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
The end of K-Billy Super Sounds, the beginning of... something anew, something
yes. different. something that that is around the corner to replace the Tarantino sized hole in our hearts. So yes, we're up to the last Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think we're going to try and do some sort of watch party or commentary, something like that. We're going to, whatever it is, me and Sal and our buddy Will Pfeiffer are going to watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood together and talk about it as we watch it.
I did want to mention also on the Patreon, you may notice on the last few episodes of Around Comics, if you're listening to this on a podcast feed, there's commercials. Patreon subscribers get commercial-free episodes. So if you're a Patreon member, you will get the regular feed episodes. They just won't have commercials in them. So
otherwise, you get ointment ads.
You get like it's mostly other podcast ads is really what we're promoting. Other types of podcasts. You know, it's like hustle and, you know, promotion. How to become a billionaire podcast and how to write a new book podcast. All sorts of stuff. But yeah, there are ads from now on our audio versions. But if you are a Patreon subscriber, you'll get.
And what if you're like me and you listen to it on your Android Auto, there's that great like 15 second.
Yo, why are you telling them that? They listen to the ads, please. It helps us support the show. If you don't want to, if you don't want to be a Patreon member, listen to the ads because it helps support the show. So thank you. I know, just, you know, turn the volume down for 30 seconds if you don't want to, but let it play and then turn the volume.
Just suck it up.
Jesus. Suck it up and listen to a commercial.
Beautiful Southeastern Wisconsin as you drive.
Fucking 17 years we've been giving you free goddamn content, you bastards. The least you could do.
I had to listen to an ad for 30 seconds, then pay up.
Joe G has a good suggestion for us. K-Billy's Ed Wood series. We'll have to do the films of Ed Wood. I would do that. God. I would totally do that.
We have Marta bought the porn movie that he directed. It's down in the basement somewhere.
Philip wants to know when the Book of the Month episode is. I think next week. Are we doing
Doing All-Star Superman?
Sure, why not? Fuck it.
Sure.
That's our new motto.
I'll read it this weekend.
Fuck it.
Yeah.
Fuck it. We did get a nice comment on Facebook on our last episode. Someone said something. A Lynn person, I can't remember the last name. Lynn said that episode was like why they listened to us all these years. So I think, just, you know,
nice.
Us bullshitting.
I think we agree.
We had a fun time with, just
good.
Horsing around here, you know?
Horsing. This is a horsing zone, guys. Horsing allowed.
This is a high horsing.
Yeah. All right. Horsing.
So trade talks next week. Sal and I, ACTV this week. We've got K-Billy Super Sounds.
I really need to get further away. I feel so weird. Are you guys sitting so far away from your computers?
I have one of the roller cart things, and so my monitor is.
Come on, Tom. Get with me on the MODOK vision. Around MODOK.
My head so close.
All right. So there you go. That's everything. Anybody got anything else? Are we good?
I think that's all I have. I think
that's it. All right. We'll be back next Thursday. Trade talks. Pull out those copies of All-Star Superman. You can also get it on Hoopla, like all of our trade talks books. In the meantime,
I'm actually reading all everything that we're doing. I'm trying to read my actual absolute versions. I have to read these at some point. So this is perfect excuse, actually.
The absolutes, because I usually will try and read those, you know, like at night, and those absolutes can, you know, just kind of, especially if you wear glasses, can overwhelm you. So thankfully, I've got the hardcovers as well. And I got the digital ones. I bought this fucking series 3 times.
I'll tell you what, though, I love about like the Absolute Sandman is as an old man with bad eyes, it's terrific. It does help, like the oversized editions. Like, oh, I can actually read this now.
Because it does get a little wordy.
Yeah, it does.
And the remastering was great. It looks beautiful.
They're so beautiful editions.
Yep. All right. In the meantime.
In between time.
Whew. We'll be everywhere. In
and around my nostrils.
Your dream.
Skin's pretty clear. Look at that.
In comics.
And yeah.
Dun 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 dun.
Last word.
Everywhere in and around.